and welcome to this episode of Talks with Tony. Gerald Ratner, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Author, mentor, keynote public speaker, entrepreneur, businessman extraordinaire. Thank you so much for joining me.
Tony, it's so nice that you've invited me. Very much appreciate it.
Really appreciate you taking the time out. So I will always start when I'm interviewing people because we do a little mini introduction. But I like you to do is if we were to say, who are you today? Who is the Gerald Ratner of today? And what do you do? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Gerald Ratner of today is, as you said in the introduction, that I do a lot of public speaking and really enjoy them because obviously during the pandemic I wasn't doing any, and it's human nature sometimes that you only appreciate things when they're taken away from you.
That's so true.
And it took a while actually after the pandemic to really get back in, to get, you know, the speeches did come back slowly, but they're now back with a vengeance. And I really, really enjoy it, meeting different people. I've set up this mentoring business with Natalie Bailey, which is doing very well, Gerald and Friends. And I wrote a book with Rob Moore, who we were talking about before we went on air, because that's probably we wouldn't have met if it wasn't for Rob. But I could say that for so many people that I've met.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, shout out for Rob. So, I'm kept pretty busy. And after when I lost my job in the 90s, I didn't really do anything for 7 years. So I feel like I retired then, so I won't be retiring till I drop dead, I don't think, now.
I think that's a good goal.
I've experienced it and I don't like it.
Yeah, so we're going to come to that. But before we do, I always like to go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, the Gerald as a child, what were your dreams, what were your hopes, what were your aspirations?
It was always to go into my father's business. And he used to take me around the shops. He had six shops with his brother and his father and another brother, I think, quite a big family business. But he used to take me round to the six shops during my school holidays, because he used to visit them on every Friday. And it was very strange because I was only about eight or nine, and that's something that businessmen don't really do, is take their children around. Yeah, so I went around in his car, and that's why I always wanted to follow in his footsteps and go into that business, which might not have done my schooling any good, because I was always just focusing on working and not really being at school. So I didn't do particularly well at school. I passed my 11 plus. And I put that down to the fact that there were only a few people in my classroom. It was a small little school, private school. Then I went to grammar school with 33 people in the class, where I came last three times in a row. And I know nowadays they put a label on you, but I'm sure there was something there that made me not concentrate or not pick up what the teachers were saying, because you didn't get this personal attention, which I got when I was younger. So it was a bit of disaster. In fact, I was expelled from school. In those days, you could expel people nowadays they wouldn't do that. They'd expel you for bad behaviour, but not for being stupid.
Your expulsion was due to struggling at school?
Yeah, the headmaster called my parents in and said, he's come last. If he comes last again, I'm going to expel him. Which is a bit harsh.
It's more than a bit harsh. Can you imagine that happening today?
Yeah, it wouldn't happen today, but it happened then. And he was the headmaster just said, no, he's not performing, and we're going to get rid of him, which he did.
So at what point, at what age were you expelled?
Well, it was only lasted a year, because I passed my 11 plus, went to the Hendon County Grammar at 12, and just served two terms. So I was only about 12.
Harsh lessons from an early age.
It was, but probably toughened me up a bit.
So that was my next question. Do you think it's actually served you in the long term? Because you've been through some major highs and some major lows within your business life. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. Life is full of setbacks, and nowadays people tend to make a big fuss about it and think that they're being singled out for bad luck or whatever, but that's life. I mean, you do, you know, you don't sail through life without any disasters happening to you. And I think the fact that I was expelled from school and the fact that I lost my job and sounds like a catalogue of disasters.
There's definitely been some successes along the way.
There will be successes, but the thing is that now minor things, which some people would make a whole big thing about, don't really bother me.
Yeah,
you become immune to it. So, you know, you toughen up, which is a good thing. And I think that is a problem we've got today, that people are dropping down snowflakes without sort of good reason to, you know.
I will definitely touch upon that. So, Dad took you around the shops aged 8 or 9. You were exposed to the world of business, so the shops being jewellery stores. You were exposed to business and you always wanted to move into that area. Why do you think your dad took you around the shops around that point in time? Was it because it was something that he wanted you to follow in his footsteps in, or was it, you know, circumstantial? Mum's working?
I really don't know. I mean, he had 3 daughters, and in those days you didn't reckon that, it's a terrible thing to say, but you didn't think of the girls as somebody that would follow you into business.
Yeah, every business was something and sons.
It was, yeah. Mm. Women didn't go into business, and it sounds ridiculous because it was only, what, 60 years ago, but they didn't really very much unless it was just to make the tea or something. It was very sad. And so I was we had 3 daughters and 1 son. I was a bit of a blue-eyed boy. I think he liked to spoil me a bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think he just wanted to encourage me into the benefits of making money at a young age, because you don't really learn that at school. And, you know, he was sort of very looking ahead, I think. And he was just... Well, I think he did want to sort of groom me to be his heir, if you like.
Yeah.
Because right through my life, he always encouraged me, you know, even when I was sort of teenager and that sort of stuff. I used to sit in his office and sort of sit and listen to his meetings and stuff like that.
So you've had exposure from a very early age of both things, both running businesses, but also living a life of privilege and living, you know, a wealthy lifestyle. And many people would rest on the laurels. You didn't. You joined the family business at what age did you officially join?
Well, the thing was that my father one day just said that he, you know, you're now 15. You can legally leave school. You're not getting anywhere. You're going backwards. You might as well just come and work for me. That's what you've always wanted to do. You're just kicking your heels, wasting your time at school. You're not going to pass any O levels or anything like that. So why don't you come work for me?
How did that make you feel? Because he's given with one hand, come and join the business that you've always wanted to give, but, you know, a little bit of tough love there.
No, he was stating the obvious. I was a complete disaster at school and I hated school. I was spending most of the time in the betting shop and it was just a complete waste of time. I just didn't take to it in any way at all. And the sooner I was released from it, the better.
What do you think of the schooling system today?
Well, I think the problem with the schooling system is that they treat everybody the same, and they prioritise certain subjects like maths, if you like, and English, and they relegate other things like music or sports, which actually, if you're a musician or a sportsman, is more important than maths and English. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and you can make just as many people do things that are outside of the main 3 subjects, but they don't prioritise that because they treat everybody exactly the same.
Yep.
So people are very different. Everyone is different. And I think it would be ideal if people could have their schooling tailored to themselves. I mean, if you go and have your hair cut,
it's not one size fits all.
No, a good hairdresser would cut your hair suited to your face and to your hair.
Yeah,
they wouldn't just do the same old haircut for everybody, but that's what it's like in education.
I agree. I think there are a lot of people who are trying to change that and who are trying to, you know, make changes, but it's an archaic system. I'm a massive believer in focusing on the areas that you're good at and strengthen those. But I find with a lot of schools and a lot, I've got two young boys who are almost 10 and 13. And a lot of the time they focus on, you're not very good at this, so let's work at it. Why don't we focus on the things that people are really good at and get them great at those instead?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody would have pointed me in a particular direction that I was good at, which was actually, strangely enough, drama.
Ah.
If they would have concentrated on that, but they didn't. You know, that I had to pass maths, I had to pass English. Yet it would have been better if I was encouraged in drama, where I did have some interest and some ability.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't do that. They'd force it.
Because I've seen you on stages and TVs and films across the world, but you were taken down a different trajectory.
Exactly. You know, it's horses for courses. Mm.
However, you were very successful in that business. So joining at the age of 15, you know, alongside your father, you built the business, Bratner's Jewellers, to huge success. So you worked really hard at it. You took it over. You grew it. You got to thousands of stores from the six in humble beginnings. What do you think were the traits that enabled you as an individual to take the company to such great strengths?
Well, it was a long period of going nowhere, because however brilliant my father was, unfortunately, he had a brain operation, which changed his personality completely. And he was so, I looked up to him so much up until then. He was absolutely brilliant, but he completely changed. Mm. And he was totally, he should have packed up. He was not in a fit state to carry on working. But he carried on running that business into the ground. Mm. And I hadn't done anything up until then. I was just, as much as I wanted to be in the business, I was just working in the shop. I wasn't of any importance to anybody. I was the gopher running up and down, delivering stock and stuff like that, which was a good, which is actually the right way to start. You shouldn't be put straight into the boardroom, because you'll just fall flat on your face. You have to learn from the
bottom up,
from the bottom up, in any field, whatever you're doing. But then I saw my, I saw the opportunity that the business was going absolutely nowhere, and it would have just probably gone bust, actually. And I was, by then, as I said, I'd spent 10, 15 years doing nothing much. I was in my 30s, and I said, right, enough is enough. I can't, I've got to take over and do things in a completely different way than my father was doing it. And because we were losing money, we were losing $34,000 a year. So I persuaded him to step down, which was not an easy thing, because he'd built that business from scratch. But in fairness to him, he did pass on the reins to me.
And then what did you do there to make, because you, it wasn't an overnight change, but it was a very quick turnaround in the grand scheme of things, having lost a lot of money year after year in the business to progressing it forward. What did you do to take it from the entity it was to the huge success that it became?
Well, it was almost an overnight change. In retail, if you change things, you can get results very quickly. And it was clear that the direction that Bratner's, the jewellers, was going was leading us nowhere, as was a lot of the jewellers in those days, because they were a bit of an anachronism. They were catering for the well-off and the sort of elderly, yet the demographics in the 80s, very different from today, were that the young people, 16 to 24s, had the disposable income. And they were going into Topshop and Next and Dixon's and stuff like that. We were not attracting those people at all. We had a threshold barrier. But we had a buyer who used to work for us when we were successful, who always made our prices competitive, and he used to hammer down the suppliers and sell products, if you like, they were a little bit cheaper than the competition. And when he left, we really went downhill. So I could clearly see that the way that he did things of being competitive, even though the jewellery business, if you like, didn't lend itself to discounting. It does now, but it didn't then. Yeah. Nobody was discounting. They felt that, you know, it had to have this prestige to it. But we went down that road of... I brought that buyer back. I had to pay him a fortune to do so, but it didn't really matter, because we had to change our appeal. And instead of selling expensive diamond rings, we started selling chains and earrings. We put all that in the front of the window. We upset a lot of people because we had banners up and we were playing pop music, and we got rid of the doors because of this threshold barrier. It was psychological to widen, to let people wander in and out with their hamburgers and coffee and all that sort of just wander about. And everything was down in price, and we screamed about that aggressively. Mm-hmm. So we did a sort of like a really discount operation, but we put that into the jewelry business. It's like Primark, if you like, today, or Aldi or something like that. That's what we were. But to do that in the jewelry business, and that's what the public want. I mean, that's what, if they didn't want that, I wouldn't have gone down that road. It wasn't my
choice. There was always a risk, though, because the jewelry business is always, as you say, the being prestige there. You know, it was the expensive items, only for the affluent, only certain people can afford it. And you changed the whole trajectory of that. There was always a risk that it would fail. Have you ever, you know, have you always been a risk taker? Have you ever been fearful of the changes?
Well, as I said to you, I spent a lot of time in the betting shop when I was at school, so I was a risk taker. I like gambling. I had nothing to lose. I wanted to be very, very successful, and I really loved taking risks. That's the excitement in business. But it was a calculated risk because of the fact that I felt that jewelry was a province of the rich, And when you have shops in Liverpool and Manchester, Newcastle, and all these places, you're really wasting your time if you try and, you know, sell very expensive stuff and just rely on a, you know, big sell occasionally. We wanted the volume.
Yeah.
And I'd seen, it wasn't my idea, I didn't innovate it. I'd seen this in one or two other jewellers. There was a jeweller called Robert Anthony who was up in Sunderland, who I was told had queues outside the door when he opened, which we'd never heard of in the jewellery business. Mm. And I went up to see him. And, yeah, he was doing all of this cheaper stuff, shouting about it, being very aggressive marketing, jewel pricing. So I clearly, and, you know, there's other evidence because I once had a watch supplier, Seiko, come into my office. And he divulged the figures of all my competitors, of how many Seiko each one was selling.
And couldn't have done that, but great news for you.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of American thing. Americans are very open with figures because when we went to America, we were told what every jeweler took, and that's why we acquired the one that was taking the most. So, yeah, sometimes you shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth. And he was telling me that Beaverbrook's were the highest at 350, Samuel's were 250, Ernest Jones were 150-ish or something like that. And I said, so Beaverbrook's are the highest, they're 350. He said, well, yeah, unless you exclude Green and Simons. If you include them, they do 800. I said, what? Green and Simons, that's a little outfit. They said, yeah, but they take our end-of-line stock. So they sell everything at half price. So that light bulb went off there again. That's clearly the way. I didn't want to take half measures. I didn't want to increase sales by 5% or 10%. Yeah. I didn't want to just go into profit. I wanted to make a big disruptive noise. Mm-hmm. And that meant a massive change of approach.
And there was upsetting some people along the way because, as you say, there were some people who didn't like, you know, the cut price stickers outside and the big banners. How do you then deal with that? Do you thrive off that when people tell you you can't or you shouldn't? Or do you ever let that hold?
Well, a lot of the managers didn't like it. They didn't want to be associated with something that they felt was tatty. Mm. But what I did introduce, which was never in the business before, was, which was very important, was what was a merit award scheme for the managers and staff, mm-hmm. that the more they took, the more they earned. Everyone was incentivized. That was absolutely vital. Again, that wasn't me that came out with that. Somebody else told me that they did that in one of the supermarkets, that everyone is incentivized and how important it is that they are. It doesn't have to be a huge amount of money, but they do have to be rewarded for outperforming.
Yep.
So I introduced that, and some of the managers didn't want to put the posters up because they felt that it was, they were in a town like Guildford or somewhere, and they felt it wasn't appropriate for such an affluent area. So I said, well, you haven't put posters up. That's fine. You do what you like. But in Kingston, where he has got his posters up, he's 35% up.
Mm.
You're only 15% up. And I think it's because you haven't got posters. And he's getting these merit awards, which you're not getting. So he quickly put the posters up.
A little bit of healthy competition and positive peer pressure there. And I think it's changing a mindset, isn't it? Changing the thought processes. And, you know, that then did bring the volume in. You went from, you know, as you mentioned, losing money within the company to making not just small amounts of money, but multi-millions. You built the company up to great success. By this point, you were still in your 30s by this point?
Yeah.
Huge achievements for someone who, you know, if you took the advice of those in schools who basically said you were stupid and would amount to nothing. So at what point did you realise, actually, I'm really good at this. This is a success.
Well, I clearly felt that after years of stagnation, working in the family business with the business going nowhere and really boring, suddenly we took off and morale, which is very important in a business, was sky high because all the managers were really happy about the sales and everybody likes working for a successful business.
Absolutely.
And we've become very successful. And I clearly felt that the approach that I'd taken was the right approach. Mm. And that added to a lot of other things in terms of marketing ourselves and being sort of very aggressive, being clever with the buying in terms of buying product.
Mm-hmm.
That was, it wasn't only a question of just getting hold of the same product and discounting it. It was actually buying a product which was lighter in weight. So, for instance, earrings, we would find a way of bringing down the price of gold earrings, which was a phenomenal seller at the time. I think there were about 15% of our sales. And we did this by actually putting a plastic tube inside a hoop earring to give it strength because the amount of gold in it was so little, it was so thin. But the technology, which has never been done in the jewellery business before, to get a big hoop gold earring and still call it gold, which it was.
Yeah.
But it was, the amount of gold that was in there was so little that it didn't even have to be hallmarked because it came under a gram.
Wow.
So, you know, we gold, if you get a piece of gold the size of this phone and it was solid gold, you could actually roll that gold from here to Edinburgh. It's so pliable. You can do anything you like with gold. You can make it thinner and thinner and thinner and lighter, which nobody ever did because they always looked at it as an investment.
Yeah.
But it's not an investment anyway once it becomes jewellery and they put their big profit margins on it,
mm-hmm.
which is 300% or 400%. So if you take away the fact that it doesn't have a resale value, it's just the aesthetics. And we, so we managed to get jewellery that looked expensive, which wasn't.
So that was the turning point, really, wasn't it, of increasing sales so dramatically.
Yeah.
Do you ever get fed up of people asking about when it all went from great success to what was effectively an overnight crash?
Well, I don't. I used to get more than fed up, but now I more or less make a living out of it because I don't think that, and it's ironic that the person who did make the biggest corporate mistake of all time, you know, has turned it into something of a positive because I certainly would not do the speeches that I did. I mean, I did an afternoon speech last night in the City of London, which was, which people found amusing that I owed the bank £1 billion. And they found it amusing that instead of making the £200 million profit that year, I had to tell the bank that we were going to miss it by £300 million. so they find that amusing. But I wouldn't be able to do an after-dinner speech like that if I was carried on being successful. So people like the calamities. And
absolutely. We all want the hero's journey, don't we?
Yeah.
And so for those people, like, they've been living under a rock, irrespective of what age they are, if people aren't aware of who you are and what you do, what you're famous for and what you were famous for. So this was in, do you know, I realised it was actually on my birthday, 23rd of April. So
right.
In 1991, you had this after dinner speech. You'd prepared for it. Your plan was to deliver it. You know, you'd become a great public speaker by this point. You delivered an after dinner speech, which then resulted in one comment or two comments being taken by And I have a huge issue. I'm from Liverpool, so we have a huge issue with the Sun newspaper anyway.
Yeah.
So it was just literally the fact that there was a journalist sat in the room who took your comments and made them public knowledge. And
yeah, well, Kelvin McKenzie, the editor of The Sun, said that, Gerald, you've done a Hillsborough, you know. That's what he says, you know. But I've been compared to a lot of terrible things, which all I did was I called a sherry decanter crap as a joke. But yeah, it wasn't an after dinner. In fact,
it was not.
Yeah, a lot of people, because it says that.
That's because people read what's in the newspaper.
Yeah, a lot of things are said, but
Tuesday old rubbish.
Yeah, but that, not that it's of any relevance whether it's after dinner or after lunch. But it was. Institute of Directors have an annual event at the Albert Hall every year. They invited me to speak. I was very honoured because it's quite a big event in front of thousands of people. There was President de Klerk of South Africa and the Chancellor of the Exchequer. You know, it was on a higher level than I was used to. And it was a reflection on where Ratness had become. And I was very proud of that. So I did a very serious speech. One of my colleagues suggested that I put in a couple of jokes. I don't think he could have imagined that it had the effect it had, that we'd be here talking about it 33 years later. But I put in those two jokes, the prawn sandwich one, which I probably would have got away with. But it was the sherry decanter joke because it had the word crap in it. And, of course, the Daily Mirror. It was the Daily Mirror that actually did the story. The Sun only changed their headline, their front page, because they saw overnight the Mirror running this story. And of course, the Mirror, being disingenuous and wanted to make this story as bad as it was, said that I said it all about my jewellery.
Yeah.
And to this day, it's on Twitter today, and so it's in the newspapers every day, that everything we sold was crap, but which was one, what it was, it was one item. But I mean, there's no point in arguing the toss. If you call one of your products crap people, then we'll assume that everything you sell is crap.
And this, I think, is, well, I have a massive issue with mainstream media anyway, because like you say, they'd taken something and it was contextual, and it wasn't it a H. Samuel item as well?
Yeah, it was. And in fact, I didn't like this sherry decanter thing, because when I was making a bid for H. Samuel, and it was quite an aggressive takeover, I had to throw things at them to say why they should sell to Ratners. And I said, well, they're selling too many gifts. They should be more concentrating on jewellery. And I said, that sherry decanter, I mean, what's that that they're selling with, you know, it's... It's, and I actually said crap then, and everybody printed it and agreed with me. So I didn't think, I thought I was on safe ground. But
so you had no idea the implications of what you'd said. You referred to a sherry decanter as a crap item.
Yeah.
Which was completely taken out of context, massively over-exaggerated to then, as you say, taken to state that all jewellery was crap.
Yeah.
The reference to, so for those who don't know, the reference to the M&S prawn sandwich, the actual, tell us what the actual phrase was.
Well, I said that we sell a pair of earrings for 99p, gold earrings as well, which is the same price as a prawn sandwich from Marks and Spencer's. But I have to say that the sandwich would probably last longer than the earrings.
Which I think is really funny, personally.
And it is funny, and a lot of people laugh, and I probably would have got away with that. I don't think the Mirror would have taken me down if it was just that. But, of course, added to the sherry decanter thing made it a stronger story for them. But there was also a fact that the journalist in the Mirror had it in for me anyway, because apparently I'd fired his niece. But I employed 27,000 people and I never met his niece. But he told his niece that he was going to get his own back on me. So, but, you know, there's no point in me sitting here being bitter about it, because, you know, everybody's a victim. I don't feel I am a victim. And, you know, so I do my speeches, and a lot of the fact is that when I go to do a speech or mentoring on a wet Tuesday night in Wigan, it's probably better that they've heard of me, even for the fact that I made those jokes rather than they haven't heard of me.
Absolutely. But yeah, it must have taken a long time. And we're going to talk about what you did and how you overcome the challenge, because, you know, you've got a great view of it now in terms of like, well, we can't change the past. And, you know, I'm not a victim. But actually, that one speech at the Institute of Directors overnight created absolute carnage when it came to the business. As you say, you were employing 27,000 people. You know, you had over 2,000 stores. You were worldwide. The business was doing absolutely phenomenal. And overnight, pretty much fell off
absolutely.
A cliff.
Nobody would come in the shops.
So it just frustrated me.
There was no social media, but word got around pretty quickly. And the brand became toxic. And I remember I was almost in tears. I was visiting the shops, and all in the olden days, we had queues of people buying our earrings and chains. Now we had queues of people asking for their money back. Every single person that came in that shop attacked our staff and said that, you know, your chairman doesn't have a very good view of your products, and that's why we want our money back. And you know, in fairness to them, if they had read that everything that I sell is crap, which actually in the speech I said that everything we sell is of the highest quality.
Yeah,
that's the irony of it. But we do have one or two, you know. Then I went about Sherry Kenter. But we have, but in fairness to the customer, if he bought his wife an engagement ring and the Daily Mirror said it was crap and everyone was saying it's crap, you wouldn't want it. And you know, because it's an engagement ring. I mean, if I'd been in the business of sort of selling books or something, it wouldn't have been a problem.
Yeah.
But jewellery is very, very personal.
Yeah. I just cannot believe that you sit here today with this viewpoint of I completely understand, because, you know, one comment taken out of context by someone who, by the sound of things, had a vendetta over something so small, changed the trajectory of your life, because you then obviously brought on someone else to try and bring the business back up to fruition and back where it was. You brought on a new CEO. You were effectively ousted from your own company. How on earth does someone manage to deal with that? Because if we look at how you were feeling at that point in time, you know, from being at the heights, driving around in amazing cars, living an amazing lifestyle, great income, to almost overnight, well, pretty much overnight, it all changing. How did you feel at that point in time? Because you've come a huge way now to be able to deal with it and more so talk about it.
Yeah, I can deal with it. I can talk about it. But I mean, if you were interviewing my wife, she would still be very bitter and say that was the day that changed our lives and changed Gerald. And he wasn't the same person after that. That's she feels, you know, that she can't forget it. And she is bitter about it. And that's not in my nature. I don't want to spend my life. You only have one life. You don't want to spend every day of it cursing yourself. And you just make the most of it. And if you take into account my life compared to most people's lives, I have to say it's been pretty good. I haven't been short of, well, I was short of money afterwards because I lost everything.
Yeah.
The shares went to 2p and had enormous debt. But without taking those 7 years out, you know, before and after, I've been... Okay, I lost the business that I want, you know, I loved and I built, but I've had lots of other excitement and enjoyment in my life. But at that time, you asked me how I dealt with it, how I felt. I didn't deal with it very well. I basically gave up, and I joke about this in the speech that I spent 7 years in bed watching Countdown. And I didn't really want to play anymore. And I believed everything that was said of the about me in the press. And the strange thing was, when I finally got out of bed and I started meeting people, like when I did my speeches or when I opened up my health club, everyone wasn't anything like what I expected. They were very friendly and supportive and not critical.
Yeah.
So I'd got a completely false view of how everybody felt about me. But
And I think a lot of people will relate to that as well. You know, one thing happens, and yours was on a grand scale because you were well known and you were in an industry where, you know, bad news travels much faster than good news. But there will be people who've undoubtedly had something happens in their life that, in the grand scheme of things, in comparison to that, is so small and minuscule, but we blow it up out of all proportion. So you had this viewpoint at that point in time that, you know, everyone was talking about you. There was all of this negativity. And during those 7 years, you joke about it, you know, you stayed at home and watched Countdown, but you actually did remove yourself from pretty much everything and everyone. having read your book, and by the way, I would absolutely recommend, I know you've written a couple of books, but I would absolutely recommend everyone read Rise, Fall and Rise Again, because that book is phenomenal and showcases, you know, the highs and lows of your journey. But through there, you talk a lot about cycling and how that helped you as a result.
Yeah, well, I was definitely, you know, people talk about young kids being depressed and anxious and all that sort of stuff for no reason. Well, I don't know what reasons they have, but it is a fact that if you don't have any money and things are really disastrous in your life and you've really lost something, albeit nobody had died, but, you know, it felt like that to me, you will suffer. You will feel depressed. It's completely natural to feel depressed. And I was in a really bad place and went and tried to get some help. And I was prescribed Prozac or the Ciroxat, which is the same thing. And that really had a detrimental effect on my life because I'm not criticizing other people for taking it. It might work for other people, maybe where they've lost somebody or whatever, because it does make you does take away a lot of anxiety and it calms you down. But in my case, just when I needed to get back on my feet, it made me satisfied with doing nothing and just giving up and being, and I didn't even talk. You know, people, I remember once we went out for dinner and somebody said, well, I'm sitting opposite Gerald. He doesn't speak. Because I didn't. When I was taking these pills, I completely went into my shell. And I had no chance of using my ability to get back on my feet. I was just going to be in limbo there. So I realized that and I stopped taking the pills. But my wife insisted that I get out of the house, which was strange because my first wife always complained that I was always out of the house. But anyway, I then sort of, just to kill time, I was cycling and I still had this bike, which is a fabulous road bike, carbon fiber. And I started cycling and cycling every day all over the place. And I was beginning to feel good, you know, about myself. I was not taking the pills anymore. And I still do this today, to this day, 25 miles a day, because even though my life is back on track, we all have bad days, you know, whatever we are. And it does deal with that. It cheers you up, albeit temporarily, but it does turn a bad day into a good day. So, I mean, everyone knows that exercise is good for mental health.
Yeah.
But they didn't really then, back in the 90s, so much. So, yeah, it was the cycling. And also, what also you get when you're exercising, especially cycling, I don't know why, but is you get your best ideas. You think clearly. You're not under pressure.
So is this one of the reasons you still cycle to this day? One, as a coping mechanism, because you know, anything can happen and you can have good and bad days, but you started getting these good ideas. So I love the story, and I think we need to share that with everyone, of how you created the business around your health clubs that you then set up. Because in reality, it should never have happened. You know, still didn't have the finances in place to go out and buy the building, set it all up. And I think there's a huge lesson in this. I'm not going to tell the story. I'd love for you to, of how you went from no business, you know, the challenges that you'd faced, to setting up a business from literally nothing. And I think people can learn so much from this story. So tell us how you set up the health clubs.
Yeah, as I said, I've been in bed for 7 years and my wife said, you just, you know, threatened to divorce me unless I got out and got a job. And we didn't have any money and we had a lot of debt. So I because I was cycling, I could see the benefits of exercise. I hadn't seen that before. So I felt that other people, I know everybody now is into it, but then in 1997 they weren't. And I could see this and I wanted to promote this and I could see the benefits. So I decided I wanted to open up a health club. And there wasn't one near where I lived, near Henley, which was quite an affluent area. And I felt it should have a health club. Nobody wanted it. Somebody would try to open one before and everyone said they didn't want it. But I found a book warehouse. So I didn't have any money whatsoever. And it was, the rent was $65,000 a year. And I took the view that if I got 3 months rent free, that this is the most ridiculous logic that ever, because it didn't take into account all the other expenses. But I took, it's just so ridiculous, my thinking, that if I didn't have to pay rent for 3 months, then I could get it all started. And by the time I have to pay rent, I would have had members' money coming in. But anyway, they wouldn't let it to me because they felt my covenant was not good enough. So I had to buy the freehold, £750,000, which of course I didn't have. But that didn't stop me. And I don't know what the law is today, but that doesn't stop you putting into solicitors' hands, even though you've got no possibility or means to exchange the deal or complete it in a month. But I did put it in because then that would give me credibility. I had this idea that I would then sell membership for this non-existent club by saying that I was in solicitors' hands and I'm about to buy it, thinking that I'm going to get the money in from and strange enough, I did, because I put an advert in the Henley Standard and I made it look fabulous. And when it opened, it didn't look anything like the artist drawing that I had. I mean, anyone would join this club because it was just sensational. It had everything in it. And I offered a free joining, which is very generous of me considering I hadn't bought the place. And I got 850 people to sign the direct debit. So then it was a no-brainer for anyone to invest in it because it couldn't go wrong. We already had the members on board. So I got the money. Even then it was a lot more difficult than I thought, but I did get the money, albeit that I was very late. I'd never exchanged when I said I was going to, but they were very patient. And I eventually did sign it. And we got another, when we opened, we got a huge amount of members because I had this, again, this is looking at the other side of the coin. Because I am who I am, I got an hour's program on BBC Two on Trouble at the Top. They did a whole thing. And after that, we got hundreds more members. Because one of the big things in any business, especially in the health club business, you just have to simply make sure that people know that you exist. Because a lot of health clubs are pretty much the same, but people don't know they exist. So everyone in Henley and in the villages around knew about this club. And they talked about it, and that's half the battle. And a lot of people joined, they never even came. But we got 2,500 members. And then one of the big chains came along and offered me £4 million 2.5 years later, which I took because I hadn't had any holiday, or my family, you know, had a very tough 7 years. And if it was just me, I would have probably carried on opened a second one. But yeah, I couldn't resist formally. And also, there was no tax on it because I'd lost so much money in the past. So
the benefit of carrying a massive tax loss.
When I phoned up my accountant, I said, "How much capital gains tax?" He says, "Nothing. You've lost more money than all our clients put together."
That's a big claim to fame.
Yeah, exactly.
This is genius, Gerald. You had this idea out on the bike where all of your best ideas come from. You're going to offer out this health club because everyone should exercise. However, you had no means. And let's be honest, in that world, you had no right to be as successful in that business as you did. And this is where your ability to take risks really came in. Saying yes to an opportunity, you know, securing a building, albeit without the funds to be able to do it. And many of the people that we work with within our, you know, mutual world in terms of property, you know, that I started in property when I first met Rob, is that, you know, quite often there are no money down deals done. There are strategies put in place to help afford it. But I just think it's absolutely genius that you foresold all of this, you know, based off an artist's drawing and an idea that you had out cycling. Massive tenacity and drive to do it. There must have been plenty of days during that time where you were close to the exchange date or you'd gone beyond the completion date. What is it that keeps you driving forward? By that point, you were so far into, you know, the challenges that you'd had, the debt that you had. What's another little bit of debt along the way? What is it that drives you forward? What keeps you moving forward?
Well, I've always felt that I've got a good gut feeling for something, and I had a good gut feeling for that club. A lot of people would start calling in people to do sort of a survey on whether that club was viable in Henley, and they would look at the demographics and they'd look at the competition. I don't do any of that. I just have a gut feeling it's going to work. When I went to America, a lot of retailers fail when they go to America. I went to America. I mean, Tesco opened up a sort of mock store for a year to try and get a gauge of what the market was like, and they failed after that. I just went into America and opened up without any
like prior research,
no research,
focus groups, etc. It was just a desire.
No analyst, nobody really. It was just that I looked around. I had a chat with the mall owners. He told me that this company Sterling were taking, how much they were taking, and I was looking at what the others were taking, and I could just see, I could just smell. So I have that confidence that you just have a gut feeling about. I think people can overanalyze, you know, and that paralysis by analysis, if you like. So I, a bit cocky, overconfident, that I feel that I do things in the opposite way than most other companies who spend too long analyzing, researching, and then, you know, just not, you know, it's like the government are always doing reviews before they make any decision. And by the time they review, everybody's so bored with it, it's just good, the moment's gone. But I would just go in there, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
So your ability to take risks, to have follow your gut, go gung-ho, all or nothing, is what's created the success. So you then created this business from nothing. You pre-sold all of the memberships to a gym that didn't even exist. You built it to a great success. You put in the hard work, and there were a lot of hours put into that. There was a lot of hard work put in, but you made it an actual success. You sold it then for $4 million, and that was in, what year was that in?
I sold it in 2001.
Yeah. So what then? In the next 20 years, tell us what happened, because you've built multiple successful businesses, you mentor people, you coach people.
Well, I then went into an online business in back into jewellery, strangely enough. And this came about because a member of the club, Jurek Piasecki, who was the chairman of Goldsmiths Group, member of my health club, suggested that I start online, and I got a partner in India to supply the product. And in the early days, and this was when the internet was not fashionable, but it was very cheap. We didn't have to, you know, now marketing costs are sort of 25% to sell jewelry online with pay-per-clicks. In those days, it was 3% because there was no competition.
Yeah.
So with the fact that people knew who I was very successfully selling his product online to the tune of about £25 million a year. We weren't making a huge profit, I have to say, even then. God knows what it'd be like today, because everyone thinks the internet's a panacea. But actually, unless you are well-known like Amazon, you have to pay through the nose to get
hits. A lot of competition.
Yeah, so it's not a panacea. It's just as difficult as the high street. But in those days, it was, in fairness. So we were early on it. And then to promote the business, the online business, I had this brilliant idea that I would go back. I thought there was one place that I would get publicity, only one place, talking about one subject. I would go back to the Albert Hall, and I emailed the Institute of Directors. And I said, why don't you have me back? It's now 2003. And they said, yes, well, don't do a speech. We'll do an interview with you, like we'll call a fireside chat. And I went back to the Albert Hall, got a standing ovation, sort of cheers before I even opened my mouth. And it went very well. And I promote, and it was on the news at 10 and everything that I'd gone back. And they felt it was wrong that they all gave me, all the members gave me a standing ovation when I was the villain who'd insulted all my customers. But it was a good bit of PR, which I knew would happen, even though I didn't want to talk. In those days, I didn't want. Nowadays, I talk about this. But in those days, I hadn't talked about it. And there was somebody in the audience from Abta Travel, who said, this is exactly what I need for our members, somebody do a speech like yours. So he booked me to do a speech in a very lovely part of the world, Marrakesh, which my wife flew out. She doesn't go to Wigan as a school now, but she went to Marrakesh. And I enjoyed doing the speech, and it went down very well. And there was agents there who heard about it, who booked me. And at the beginning, I was turning over £500,000 a year in speeches. And I thought, this is the easiest money that I've ever made. It's 100% profit. I love doing it. I'm traveling around to lovely places. I'm doing similar speech. It's not a huge amount of effort. This is great. Why did I slog my guts out in the jewelry business? And I'm making a nice living and traveling around. And I've been doing it ever since, albeit it's not at the same level that it was. But it put me back in the limelight to a certain degree, and it was very cathartic, because people don't realize, if something disastrously happens to you, in a way it's better to get it out and talk about it than sort of bottle it all up. And when I started talking about it and joking about it like everybody else, because when I do my speeches, there's nothing bitter or serious about it. It's just although there is an underlying serious message, it's delivered in a very lighthearted, jokey way, which I get a lot of laughs. So when you start doing that, somehow you come to terms with it. And it's something that is part of me, like a scar, that surprisingly that you come to love, even though it's the worst thing that ever happened to you.
I think there's a huge lesson for people here. And I think that I want to touch upon what you'd said in terms of talking about it, because your instinct was to not talk about it. You know, you pretty much didn't speak to people for 7 years. The challenge there is that when you realised it's like therapy, talking about the thing that happened. And not only that, your speeches are so inspirational. They motivate people. There are always people who are facing challenges. And, you know, even if they're using it as perspective to then say, yeah, but it's not as bad. Because one of the things that came about as a result of this, which was a negative connotation to the phrase and the terminology, but actually you've used to your advantage within your speeches, it became known as doing a ratna. So doing a ratna being, you know, making a mistake. But from that mistake, you've created some amazing successes. You know, your desire to become a public speaker, then you now stand on stages, as you say, you know, making £500,000 a year from what was perceived to be an awful mistake. I think you need to, you know, not enough people give credit where it's due in terms of your ability to be willing to take risks, to be willing to not take yourself too seriously, and use that for the positives, because it did lead to you writing the first book, which was about your, you know, the highs and the lows, reaching the heights, you know, the lows of rise, fall, and then rise again, and building businesses thereafter. So what is it that you love so much about delivering the speeches?
I like making people laugh, and that's how I got into trouble in the first place at the Albert Hall. And I was like that as a kid. You know, you asked me earlier about a kid, and I wasn't very good at lessons, but I was good at making people laugh at school. And laughter is something that is very important in life. You know, you're happy when you're laughing. So it's great to go to these events. I did Wembley Arena in front of 2,500 people a few weeks ago, and told them that King Charles, when he had that trouble with the pen and the ink was going everywhere, that I decided to tweet, which was a joke, that I'd sold him the pen. And I got about 35,000 likes, and people found it very funny. So some people get their kicks from different ways. They don't want to make people laugh, but I get a lot of pleasure from trying to be funny. Sometimes it doesn't work, and it can be really annoying. But, you know, somebody once said that most comedians want to be millionaires, but here's a millionaire who wants to be a comedian. So whatever.
Have you ever done a stand-up gig? Would you ever do it?
No, I never tell a joke. I don't find jokes funny in any way. I find life funny.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell a joke.
Observational comedy is huge, though. You could use that. You should totally do a stand-up gig.
Well, the thing is that, you know, when you get somebody at these events that I go to, is often the chairman of the company, before he introduces me, has busy day, loads of work, and his secretary said, oh, you know, you've got to say a few words tonight. he'll start off with a joke. He'll go on the internet and he'll look for the first joke and he'll relay that and everyone will go, ugh, that wasn't funny, which it never is. But what is funny is just things, anecdotes, things that actually happen to you that are true in life. When I've tried to make them up, for some reason, whether it's my delivery or whatever, people don't laugh. When something happens that is absolutely true, like I, with the Royal Bank of Scotland in 2008, I got a phone call from a journalist who said that your old company being listed on the US stock market. And I said, if that's the case, they will sell their UK division. She said, would you be interested in buying it? And I said, well, it's £350 million. I'd have to borrow the money. And she said, where would you borrow it from? And I said, well, actually, the Royal Bank of Scotland will lend it to me. And I made that up completely. And that was in the paper. And on the Monday, the Royal Bank of Scotland read it and they said, do you know anything about this? Who have you been dealing with? And I said, I made it up. And they said, well, that doesn't matter. We'll still lend you the money. So that was true. It actually happened. And when I put the phone down, I couldn't believe that they said they'd still, which gives you an indication the Royal Bank of Scotland's lending more than 2009. But it was so ridiculous. And life is much funnier than any joke that you can make up.
I just love your self-deprecating humour. You're not afraid to put yourself as, you know, the person who is effectively the butt of the joke. Taking yourself too seriously can often lead to challenges.
I did for a long time. Yeah. It really hurt. Everybody was making jokes in weddings and it was like all the comedians included me. I went to a pantomime with my daughter and Ernie Wise was going on about me on the stage. I couldn't believe it, but it was happening everywhere and I hated it. Mm. I absolutely hated it. And it was only when I joined them, if you can't beat them, join them and laugh about it yourself, that
you could still be in that depression now.
Yeah, probably still be lying in bed watching Countdown.
The irony being that's still going. What do you think was the turning point for you then in terms of, you know, identifying that actually they're going to make the jokes anyway, if you can't beat them, join them? Was there a particular defining moment? Did you wake up one day, or was it literally, you know, your lovely other half, Moira, then saying it's, you know, my way or the highway?
It was purely making money again. It was after being skint, having a huge amount of debts, and then getting that £4 million and being successful again. It was purely about that. You know, when you're lying in the gutter, everybody would have a kick at you. And the only way to get out of that gutter is to get up and stand up. And I could put that behind me once I was successful again. So the health club, not only was getting involved in cycling and getting healthy and fit better, because instead of drinking a bottle of wine and just going out on your back and doing exercise, you just you look at life in a totally more optimistic way. You're just happier, and even if nothing's changed, if you're just wallowing in your own grief, if you're lying there thinking about all your enemies, it's just not healthy.
And your ability to then change that and use it to fuel you, which led to you delivering more and more speeches. So back to the scene of the crime, if you will.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But from there, you've then, you know, generated this massive income, entertained millions of people during that time with your speeches, your keynotes, your after dinner speeches. But then you actually moved into, how did you then move into mentoring in business? Because surely there were people along the way who've gone, Gerald, you can't do this. Look what happened with your business.
You'd think, I mean, when I said to a friend of mine that I'm going to start this mentoring club and it's going to be £50 a month to get financial advice of how to build businesses, my friend said, can I pay £100 a month not to get your advice?
And that was a great business model.
If you read Twitter, people will say, you know, they will still say that I'm the biggest idiot that ever lived, and they will compare anybody that screws up and doing a Ratner. So it is a bit ironic that I had the nerve to start mentoring. But when when the pandemic started, I couldn't do any speeches, wasn't getting any government support particularly, and had to do something. And that was the only thing to do on Zoom. People were doing it on Zoom. I got a few offers. Mm-hmm. for stuff. And then I got people saying, would you do the mentoring? Because everybody was up for it. They had nothing else to do. And I then, when I started getting the, and the mentoring is not as lucrative as the public speaking. Nothing is as lucrative. If you see these articles in the paper where they do these interviews with people, me and my money and all that sort of stuff, they'll always say, what was the most lucrative thing? And they say corporate speaking. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so mentoring isn't that, but I do enjoy it. And I was doing a lot of one-to-one during the pandemic. And if it wasn't for Zoom, you couldn't really do it because it just wouldn't stack up to meet somebody, the cost of it. And the people are, a lot of people from your neck of the woods, I don't know why, in Liverpool, which I do quite a few, and these guys, like, making a lot of money, much more money. I'm mentoring people that are much more successful than me at the moment. And there's one guy who just does pallets, buys pallets and sells pallets, and he's just a fantastic guy, and he's making a fortune. And, you know, I advise him. And so then I sort of widened it and went with Natalie into Gerald at Friends, thinking, you know, start a club. Because I heard about this guy who was giving advice to women. He was like a niche thing, which was very clever. He was giving advice to divorced women on legal advice and financial advice, and he was turning over the most astronomical amount of money. I mean, if I told you the figure, you wouldn't believe it. This is in America, where all the numbers are much bigger. But he was turning over $7 million a month just with his club. So I thought, oh, I could fancy $7 million. So don't
I'll
quite
have a
make,
piece of that.
Yeah, I'll have a piece of that. So I started up with, and I don't really do the administration stuff, and I don't even know how to do Zoom properly unless I get an invitation. So Natalie, and also Natalie has a lot of contacts and stuff like that. And I had the idea of joining with Natalie Bailey. So we'd started that only about, 6 months ago or something. So we already got 70 people. Which I do every Tuesday, we do that. And I really find that more tougher in a way than the public speaking. So talking about getting my best ideas on the bike, I have to come up with, not every week, but a lot of the time I have to come up with a half an hour talk about a subject. Mm-hmm. And for once, I can't talk about my chosen subject, about my downfall at the Albert Hall or me. I have to talk about personal branding, or I have to talk about artificial intelligence, or I have to talk about my top 10 tips or something. So I have to keep coming up with things to talk about. And that's when I go on my bike. Mm. On the Thursday or the Wednesday, I have to get on that bike, even if it's raining, because that's the only thing time it will come to me what to say.
And that's still the case to this day. Still, you still get your best ideas when the endorphins are running around your body and you're exercising.
When my daughter's got a problem, I say, well, I'm just going back. And it does come to you. The solution comes to you. I don't know why that is, but it does. You just feel in a relaxed state of mind where nothing is cluttering up your brain. So you can solve problems that way.
And I believe that you'd be able to solve any problem that came your way. You've had the heights and you've had the lows, and now, you know, are you happy now?
Do I look happy?
You do.
Sometimes. Don't have to be polite.
No, you're smiling. You've smiled more in this interview. I'm going to take full credit. You've smiled a lot more in this interview than I've ever seen.
The reason I said do I look happy is because I clearly don't. And everybody always says, but I can't help it. That's my face. It's a miserable face. But it doesn't mean that I'm not happy. And the irony is, as you said, that I had the all the trappings of wealth, the helicopter, the private jet, the boats, the houses. And it doesn't make, I know it's everybody says, but it doesn't make you happy. It really doesn't. You do have to appreciate things. Mm-hmm. And the fact I lost all of those things, and now my businesses or my income is nothing like what it was. You say I've got this massive income. It's not really massive, but it's enough to make me happy, mm-hmm. to buy the things that I want. And that's all. And you do appreciate those things.
Yeah. So are you, in a bizarre way, are you grateful for what happened because it's made you appreciate it more? Or, you know, if you could turn back the clock to the 22nd of April on that, you know, the night before that speech, would you change it?
Well, I start off my speech by saying that that was 33 years ago, and it seems like yesterday, and I wish it was tomorrow because I'd cancel it. So, and then we had a event where I said that if we're doing Q&As, can you plant a question? Because nobody ever wants to ask the first question. Then we get loads of them. So he said, well, what do you want me to ask you? I said, ask me if I regret saying what I said at the Albert Hall. So nobody asked the first question and there was silence. And he stood up and says, Gerald, did you regret saying what you said? And I said, that's the most stupid question. And he said, of course I bloody regret it. It's a bloody disaster. I lost everything. And worse still, that my staff lost their jobs. And yes, it was a nightmare. So what a stupid question. But he says, yeah, but now you're happier. You've got enough money. You've got a nice lifestyle. You appreciate things. You've just told us all of this. You might not have had that, you know, running a public company, all the pressures and stuff like that. Mm. And I said, yeah, and I wouldn't be cycling either. You're right, which I love. So, yes, I apologise for saying that was a stupid question. There is some truth in what you're saying. Nobody knows whether it was good for me or bad for me. But even if we're debating it, it's quite unbelievable to think that it was the worst mistake of all time, a corporate mistake of all time. And here we are thinking, well, was it good? Mm. You know, it's that does cheer me up a bit. And sometimes when I do a speech and people say, oh, well, nobody, they haven't heard of you. When I said Gerald Ratner speaking, they never heard of you. And I think, oh, that's a shame, but which is ridiculous because the only others have heard of me because of my speech. So
that's a dichotomy, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
it
which
is.
It's paradoxical, isn't it? You know, I wish they'd have heard of me because I want everyone to have heard of me. But the irony being, most people who have heard of you is because of something
exactly
that was perceived to be negative.
That's crazy.
So what's next for you, Gerald? What's next on the horizon for you? What have you got aspirations to do? What's still left to tick off the bucket list of life, if you were?
Well, one of my mentors wanted to buy 5 jewellery shops and do this acquisition. And he was telling me about these shops and I was looking at them and it was driving me mad because the way they were run was not the way I would run a jewellery shop. So he said, well, why don't you come in with me? And I thought, oh, do I want to do this? Can I really? But I couldn't resist it. So
the gambler inside
exactly,
of you.
Exactly, because I could see the benefit. I could see what I could do because of the fact that this business had never, ever had a sale because they ran it in the way that when I took over Ratner's, that way, that mentality that you have to make a profit margin, that you can't be busy fools. But unfortunately, nothing sells unless you discount it. And it's more true today than it ever was. So I couldn't resist the fact that I could do something, get involved in that. And it was very exciting. I went down all the way down to one of the shops in Torquay, talked to the managers. And of course, when I arrived, they all knew me because they worked for me. Most, you know, I had 50% of the jewelry business. So a hell of a lot of people in the jewelry business had worked for me. And they all gave me a wonderful greeting and stuff like that. And it was like old times, even though it was one shop, not 2,500 shops.
So you're back in business in the jewellery trade. You're now working with your mentees. So you're investing into businesses, helping people from the mentoring perspective, running your Gerald and Friends programme. I'm so grateful for the time that you've shared with me today. I am conscious of your time. I want to make sure I don't overstep, but I do have one final question before we finish. And the question is, what is the one question no one ever asks you that you'd love to be asked? Or what is the one subject matter that no one ever discusses with you that you think is really important?
God, that's a difficult question because people ask me all the things you'd expect them to ask about your ups and downs and calamities and stuff like that. And what would I like them to ask me?
Yeah. Well, what subject matter do you think's really interesting but no one ever discusses on interviews, on podcasts, you know, face to face?
Well, I think the fact is that there's more to people than what they've heard about. They seem to think that my life only existed in the Albert Hall. Nothing ever.
Nothing preceded it. Nothing's happened since.
And there's nothing in it other than that. That is it. That's the way people perceive you if you've done something like I've done. They don't realise there is
more to you than that.
There's more to me than that. I love music. I love reading. I'm interested in politics. In fact, I was invited to go on GB News, you'd be shocked to hear, as a pundit to talk. And it was nice to go on there and not talk about myself for once, to go on television and to talk about the stories of the day. They haven't invited me back, but anyway, I enjoyed my moment there of doing, even though at my age, it's nice to suddenly do something that you've never done before, totally different. So I'm sure if I hadn't done that speech, I'd still be doing the same thing the whole time in that same office. So that's given me the opportunity. But I haven't answered your question.
That's all right. The question is supposed to do exactly that, make you think. Because so often people ask, and especially in your circumstance, I've interviewed a lot of people, and I never want my interviews to be exactly the same as somebody else's. And I think, but with your life and with what's happened, people are always going to talk about, you know, that one fateful day, good or bad. But I think it's really interesting for me to hear what's happened since, what you're doing now, where your drive is, where your focus is. And the fact that we started this podcast best part of an hour ago with you saying, I'm going to continue doing it until I drop dead. I think it's amazing that we've got many, many years left of seeing your successes grow, investing in other people's business, mentoring, coaching people, and continuing to deliver those speeches despite what's happened. I think it's absolutely fabulous what you're doing. For anyone who's not yet read any of Gerald's books, I absolutely recommend that you do. So we've got Rise, Fall and Rise Again, and then the one that you co-authored with our joint mutual friend Rob Moore, which is Reinvent Yourself. If you want to hear any more from Gerald, if you'd love to get involved with what he's doing, we're going to put all of the links to the social media channels and to everything that he does into the show notes. And from a personal perspective, I want to say a huge thank you for giving up your time today. I really appreciate it.
Tony, thank you, ma'am. I have to say that it has been a different podcast from anyone I've done before. I would say that.
Is that good or bad?
It's definitely good. It's got to be good. You've made me be fairly candid, I would say, to say the least. So I do appreciate your questions and really enjoyed your company.
And I appreciate you answering them so candidly too. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tony.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, that was great.